Today is Tuesday, December 5th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Yemen's former president is killed after Houthi rebels stop his motorcade. The U.S. pulls out of a migrant and refugee pact.
It's unfortunate not to have the benefit of the experience, a long, very positive experience of the United States with migration.
Republicans hope to unite and give the president a win on taxes. Also ahead, we get reviews of a couple of big movies now in U.S. theaters. It's all on today's International Edition. Yemen's longtime former president Ali Abdullah Saleh was killed in a roadside attack Monday after switching sides in Yemen's civil war. Saleh abandoned his Iran-aligned Houthi allies in favor of the Saudi-led coalition. As for the implications for the war-ravaged nation, VOA's Victor Beatty asks Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal if he agrees with many analysts who say the death could be a huge morale boost for the Houthis and a serious blow to the Saudi-led coalition.
They're probably right about that. In Yemen, by and large, it's a game of the Machiavellians. All these characters, whether it's Saleh himself and his team, or whether it is the Houthis, etc., they all double-cross each other all the time, and they also work with each other where it benefits and helps them. What happened was that there was a sense of a lull after that last Saudi attack over there, and a number of people had been killed. And the presumption was, look, now is the time coming around where some sort of rapprochement could be reached, that some sort of peace could be achieved, some degree of non-violence could be realized, which could then lead to something else. And the Saudis seem to have sent some messages along that line, indicating that if that weren't to happen, they would attack even more fiercely than they had done in the past. So it was under those circumstances that both sides were trying to, quote-unquote, establish their own foundations for the future. And that's where Saleh went wrong. Saleh went too far in supporting the Saudi-UAE group. And in the process, he was expecting and hoping that the Saudis and the UAE would be supporting him and sending in forces that will reinforce his forces in Sana'a to fight against Houthis. It didn't happen. Because it didn't happen, Houthis won. When the Houthis won, Saleh ran in panic, and that's when he got killed. So under the circumstances, now you have a situation where the Saudi-UAE duo is really not as comfortable and as acceptable in that region, even for those people who are against the Houthis. And at the same time, Houthis have become more powerful. So we now have a situation where things are going to get worse rather than better.
Hundreds have been killed or wounded in the latest urban combat in and around the capital, Sana'a. What happens to the Saleh forces, the forces loyal to the now deceased former president?
There will still be fights with the Houthis, but my feeling is this, because their morale level is very low, they will leave the capital city, Sana'a, and they'll go back to the mountains and to their tribal areas. And with them, the conflict will also spread to other areas and away from Sana'a.
The current president, Rabd Abu Mansur Hadi, in a speech carried on Saudi Al Arabiya television, called for a new chapter in the battle against the Houthis after the Saleh death. He called upon the Yemeni people in all provinces still suffering under this criminal and terrorist militia to rise in its face and cast it out. Will they?
No. Well, look, the point is very simple. How do you expect these poor people who are dying like anything because of cholera and diphtheria and all other diseases, how do you expect them to stand up and fight? I mean, this is a whole silly idea. And especially coming from all the people from Hadi, Hadi himself has been responsible for some of the major catastrophes in the place because he supported, he agreed to put his forces for certain things, and it did not deliver. So people are not really going to be seriously listening to him. I think more important issue is going to be Saleh's children, especially his son, Ahmad Ali. he could very well bring together some of the people who were very close, the tribals and others, together, and could still fight on the same basis as his father would have done it. The problem is more complicated. The problem is that Ahmad Ali does not like the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. They, in fact, last time they met, it was a very unpleasant meeting. And there was a lot of shouting that went on, and they could have come to blows if they hadn't been held separately. So my problem, what I'm trying to emphasize is that for Ahmad Ali to be able to stand up and do something substantive in support of the revised understanding that was reached with the Saudi UAE forces, he was to get the support. And very solid, very strong material as well as military support. I don't see it coming. And if it's not coming, then forget it. He's not about to, quote-unquote, lay his life down like his father.
Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal. The United Nations says it regrets the Trump administration's decision to pull out of the Global Compact on Migration. The U.S. announcement came just before the start Monday of a global conference on migration in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. The New York delegation for refugees and migrants was adopted on the margins of the U.N. General Assembly's annual leaders gathering in September of 2016. VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir joins us now for more on this. So, Margaret, what exactly is this compact all about?
The New York Declaration for Refugees and Migrants is a compact that was adopted on the margins of last year's UN General Assembly. And so countries decided that they would begin a process to draft an agreement that covers all aspects of migration. They want to make it safe, orderly, and regular. They want to make it, you know, safer for people to migrate, because then you have all these issues of human trafficking and exploitation of people. So this is geared to avoid that in the future going forward, because let's face it, migration is a phenomenon that is here to stay. So countries can't ignore it anymore, and now they need to deal with it. So the U.S. announced that they were not going to engage in these negotiations. So what's happening now is in Mexico, all the countries are there, and they're sort of laying out the elements that are going to go into the first draft of this agreement, and they're going to begin, that's going to be their point of negotiation. They're going to start with this draft. So
right.
That's where we're at right now in Mexico. And then the idea is in a year, they would have a big summit, I guess probably in New York, and they would formalize it. So much like we saw with climate change, there was a lengthy negotiation process before we got to Paris.
So what does it mean that the Trump administration decided they do not want to be a part of this?
Well, what the Trump administration is saying is that they want to have all decisions related to migration in the United States being solely a U.S. domestic decision. But what the U.N. and their partners are saying is, look, this agreement, by the way, is not legally binding that we're trying to work out. It's more of a cooperation agreement. And so by being in this, you're not going to lose your sovereignty. You're not going to lose your ability to make decisions. And by its very definition, migration means people going from one country to another. So that would mean, you know, at least two countries are involved. So everybody's got to respect domestic laws in those countries. But this is going to give us a framework for dealing with the challenges that we all are facing.
And I understand that you actually interviewed someone higher up in this negotiation process.
Well, I just spoke with Louise Arbour, who's the Secretary General Special Representative for International Migration. She's in charge of this whole process, and she's in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, where this meeting is going on.
You know, I think it's unfortunate not to have the benefit of the experience, a long, very positive experience of the United States with migration, but the process, I think, you know, as very much has its own momentum, is moving forward very nicely.
And, you know, she, like everyone else at the UN, is disappointed to see the United States pull out of this process. But she said, you know, the process has its own momentum, and it's moving forward very nicely, and it will continue to go forward. But that it would have been nice to have had the very long positive experience of the United States with migration as part of that.
It sounds like Attorney General Jeff Sessions and Chief of Staff John Kelly were both very in favor of pulling out of this, but U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Nikki Haley thought that it was a good idea to continue.
Right. So, look, it's going to be a lengthy process, at least next year. Oftentimes, these things go longer. I mean, they hope to have a deal by next year. That doesn't necessarily mean they will get one, so it could drag on. So, you know what? It could drag on to another administration that would like to reengage. Hmm. So you just never know. And again, it's a non-binding document. It's not legally binding. So it will not impose any obligations on the United States that would run counter to its own domestic laws. It's basically a cooperation framework. So, at one point we thought Donald Trump might reengage on climate change, then he didn't. So there's some back and forth in this administration. Maybe he changes mind, but I think it's a very strong issue with his base, the idea of building walls and keeping out illegal immigrants. So I'm not sure that even he'd be open to legal routes of migration for people coming to this country.
That's VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. Supreme Court allows full enforcement of the Trump travel ban. Secretary Mattis tells Pakistan to redouble its efforts to confront terrorists. Britain and the EU fail to reach the Brexit divorce pact. And reports say Trump had been told that Flynn had misled the FBI. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Republicans pushed a nearly $1.5 trillion tax bill through the Senate early Saturday after a burst of 11th-hour horse trading as a party starved all year for a major legislative triumph took a giant step toward giving President Trump one of his top priorities by Christmas. Republicans touted the package as one that would benefit people of all incomes and ignite the economy. The Republican-led House approved a similar bill last month in what has been a stunningly swift trip through Congress for complex legislation that impacts the breadth of American society. The two chambers are now trying to craft a compromise to send to the president. The issue is important because the party views passage as crucial to retaining its House and Senate majorities in next year's elections. Joining us now to explain is Howard Gleckman, senior fellow at the Tax Policy Center. So tell us about these bills.
The House and the Senate bills have some differences, but at bottom, they're essentially the same bill. There's really very little difference in the big themes of these bills, and that is they are both very large tax cuts for corporations. They're tax cuts for non-corporate businesses, and they're kind of a modest tax cut for low and middle income households, at least through 2025. Senate bill after 2025 appeals all the tax changes for individuals so that after that, there'd essentially be no change at all.
The president has said it will lower taxes on the middle class and it will hurt him. Is that true?
We don't know about him because, of course, he hasn't disclosed his tax returns. First president in 40 years to not do that. But what we do know, we saw a bit of his 2005 tax return. And we know something about how he makes his living. And it's pretty clear that this bill is full of tax breaks. Can't say how it affects him specifically, but people like him, people who make their money through limited partnerships, people who have lots of royalty income, people who have lots of real estate assets, would all pay lower taxes under either of these bills than they would under current law. As far as middle-income people are concerned, the president has said this would be the biggest tax cut in history for them, and it certainly won't be that. It would be, at least at the beginning, a modest tax cut for most middle-income people. We estimate that in 2019, about 90% of households would get a tax cut. It would average about $1,200, although most of that benefit would go to high-income people. We estimate that middle-income people would get a tax cut of about $850, and low-income people would get a tax cut of a few hundred dollars. But that's only until 2025. After all those individual income tax changes expire, at least in the Senate bill, middle-income people would essentially get nothing on average, households would get a tax cut of a few hundred dollars, and low-income people might pay a little more. We estimated that by 2027, about half of all households, mostly low and moderate-income people, would pay more in taxes under this bill than they would under current law.
And then there's the issue of the deficit. Republicans have long been strong advocates for not only not increasing the deficit, but reducing it. What does this do to the nation's deficit?
So the Joint Committee on Taxation, the Congressional Budget Office, the Tax Policy Center, and the Wharton School at University of Pennsylvania have all estimated this, and they have all come to essentially the same conclusion, that this bill would add $1 trillion or more to deficits over the next 10 years, even after taking into account the economic effects of the tax cuts. The White House insists that it would pay for itself, the tax cuts would pay for themselves, but there's simply no economic evidence that that's true. So what you have is a bill that would add at least $1 trillion to deficits, and that assumes that many of these tax cuts would expire as scheduled. Republicans have been saying quite candidly that that's just a budget gimmick, and that they expect that those tax cuts would actually be extended before they expire, and that would mean that the cost of this bill would be even greater. So what it means essentially is that if you care about budget deficits, it's hard to explain how it is you could vote for this bill. As you know, at the very end, Senator Corker was one of the few budget hawks, was the only budget hawk in the Senate, who voted against it. Other people who have styled themselves as deficit hawks for years and years, in the end, voted for it.
You're saying that if this does spur some growth, it will help a little bit with the deficit not increasing as much. But what if it doesn't spur growth, or will it spur growth?
Well, you have to predict. Taxes are only a small part of the economic equation. The economy will grow mostly because there's more demand for the goods and services that American companies produce. It will grow because there are more workers, or because the workers can use equipment to make things more productively. And maybe on the margin, it might grow a little bit because taxes are lower. But mostly, economic growth is a consequence of all these other issues. So the truth is that 10 years from now, when historians look back and say, did this tax cut contribute to economic growth? The honest answer is going to be, we don't know.
All right. Well, I guess we'll check back in 10 years. Howard Gleckman, Senior Fellow at the Tax Policy Center, thank you so much for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues as we turn to our social media segment. We're joined by VOA's Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, so anything going on today?
Oh, there's always something going on, and usually it involves young people on social media. Young people are always kind of the pioneers. They're the ones who embrace the
right.
different social networks. Their heads are buried in their
Except
smartphones.
Except for the president, who's very into social media.
Well, it spans the ages now, but That's young people
true.
Are usually the ones that they
right.
They get involved with. Remember that Facebook started as a way for college students to get in contact with each other
okay.
before it expanded worldwide. Well, Facebook is now taking this to a new extreme because they have launched Facebook Messenger for Kids. It allows children age 6 to 12 to get on Facebook Messenger and communicate with friends and family. Now, this has become a point of contention on the internet. A lot of people are saying that ages 6 to 12 is too young for kids to be on social media. Facebook counters that by saying that it's a way to get these kids digitally literate at a young age. They also say that these kids have to have a parent register them on Facebook Messenger for Kids because you can't be under 12 and have a Facebook account. The minimum age you can be for Facebook is 13. And they say that parents will be monitoring what their children will be doing on this Facebook Messenger for kids. So Facebook is saying it's a way to get kids to chat with their friends and family. Skeptics and cynics say that it's something that Facebook is maybe using to try to hook these kids at a young age. Facebook has had problems in the past with trying to attract young people as they've fled for apps like Snapchat that are more visual. So they're saying this could be a way for Facebook to try to get younger people earlier and get them on Facebook.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Future social media addicts, I guess.
I guess, trying to get them at a young age and trying to hook them early.
For sure. What else you got? Anything?
Yes, sad news that Ivan Chermayev has died at the age of 85. Now, this was not a name that I was familiar with.
Mm-mm.
Probably not a name that
no,
you're familiar
never
with.
Heard of
Probably
him.
Not a name our listeners are familiar with, but I am willing to bet that you, me, and all of our listeners have seen Ivan Chermayev's work multiple times as we've gone through our days.
Really?
Because here's what Ivan Chermayev did. He was a graphic designer who, with his firm Chermayev and Geismar, designed some of the most iconic brand logos in the world. And I want to just read a brief list of some of the hundreds of logos that they've designed.
Okay.
Things like logos for the Smithsonian Institution, the Library of Congress, the Museum of Modern Art in New York, National Geographic, the NBC Peacock for the National Broadcasting Company here in the U.S., Public Broadcasting Service logo, Cornell University, Brown University, New York University, all of their logos, Chase Bank, the Bank of Taipei, Armani Exchange, Mobil Oil, Pan Am Airlines, the United Nations Development Program, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the Kennedy Center Honors, and the list goes on and on and on and on. So someone who is a titan of design, a titan in the commerce world and in the art world, and someone who's being very much missed online for the impact that he has had on the things that we use and see every day. A lot of people going online saying, I never realized that he designed all these logos, and some of people's favorite logos, the Chase logo and its simplicity, or the Kennedy Center Honors logo with its kind of rainbow.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually the design for the rainbow ribbon that the honorees wear actually came from Ivan Chermayev. So someone who had a huge impact and someone who is very much missed.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Lori.
All right. And you can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA underscore IE. And turning now to the latest big movies out in U.S. theaters, we're joined by Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. So, Jeff, there's a mystery, murder mystery, that has a pretty impressive cast, and it's got a long name, this movie, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. That's the name?
And not since, you know, The Incredibly Strange Creatures Who Stopped Living and Became Mixed Up Zombies has a title really been hard to remember and pronounce, like Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Right.
But, yeah, this is based on the true events of Mildred Hayes, whose daughter was raped and killed outside of Ebbing, Missouri, and she makes this bold move by painting three billboards, hiring three billboards for a year, leading into her town with a controversial message directed at William Willoughby, which is the town's sheriff. He's the chief of police, who's just beloved. So he's like, you know, 7 months that it's stalled, the investigation. Mm-hmm. It's gone cold. So the mother, Mildred Hayes, played by Frances McDormand, she's determined to say, look, you know, I want satisfaction. I want justice for my daughter. But of course, she alienates the entire town she's from because she's, you know, trashing the chief of police who everyone adores. And of course, her second in command, the chief of police, his deputy, is played by Sam Rockwell. He's a racist. He's someone who's just out to do to protect the sheriff at any cost. So the movie is really a dark comedy, but it's also full of emotion, and it's filled with some of the best performances of the year. So it's really an emotional thriller that holds your attention. It's because it's really a great masterpiece of dark comedy, and it's from Martin McDowell, who's done like 7 Psychopaths last year. So it's just a really amazing film that's just full of a mother's anguish and someone who's just back is against the wall who wants justice.
I want to know what the ending is, but I don't want to give it away. So even though it is a true story, we already probably could find out, but I'll leave it.
It's true life, so I'm not going to ruin it for you. But you know, if you see this movie, even though it's got one of the most unique titles of the year, it's an actor's movie. It really is. Because Woody Harrelson plays the chief of police, just delivers, again, one of the most amazing performances. I'm just a fan of this movie so much. It's going to end up in my top 10 films of 2017.
Fabulous. Well, a lighter, more fun movie for the whole family, including the kids. Disney, Pixar has Coco, and who can't relate to a kid wanting to become a rock star?
Absolutely. You know, despite his family generation's ban on music, you know, Miguel dreams of becoming a musician like his idol, Ernesto de la Cruz. And he wants to follow in his footsteps, but his family are shoemakers. And they're telling Miguel, look, something happened in our family. We don't celebrate music. We don't sing. You're going to just have a miserable existence. But of course, this centers around Day of the Dead, the celebration after Halloween that the Mexican culture does. And so he goes into the land of the dead to find his relatives and to get their permission to celebrate music. And I'm telling you, I went into this movie thinking, well, it's going to be corny. I'm really done with these animated films. And I came out with not only just an incredible musical experience and cultural experience from the Latino community, learning so much about their traditions and their family and all of that, but also one of the most beautiful looking films and also one of the funniest, heartwarming, heart-touching films I've seen in a long time. I can't believe that I'm saying that this movie is going to end up in my top five for 2017. It is that good. Disney Pixar has such a hit on their hands, but it crosses all boundaries in terms of culture, music. Yeah, it's just, you're going to bawl your eyes out.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people talking about it that were not children.
No. I've watched it twice now, and I'm probably going to see it a third time.
Wow.
And it's just a beautiful film. And they've worked on this movie for like
Fantastic.
7 or 8 years. This is the longest Disney and Pixar have worked on a story. Not only just culturally, you know, respectful, but they had experts working on translating that to the big screen. The Latino community is going to rally around this movie, and it's just beautiful. I love it. I love it. I love it.
Jeffrey K. Howard, you can find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. And you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at VOAnews.com. Thank you for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Keith Holmes. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Gone are the days when the Taliban, citing religious objections to opiates, banned the growing of poppies. Now, up to 85% of the world's opium production occurs in areas under Taliban influence, leading to the Taliban and other non-state armed groups annually lining their pockets and financing nefarious activities with hundreds of millions of dollars from the illegal drug trade. But the United States and its Afghan partners have the Taliban's narcotics networks squarely in their sights. In November, the allies began targeted strikes on Taliban drug labs, including airstrikes by U.S. forces that are part of the expanded legal authorities given to the U.S. military under President Donald Trump's new strategy for Afghanistan, announced in August. At a recent press briefing, General John Nicholson, commander of Resolute Support and U.S. Forces Afghanistan, said the new authorities are a demonstration of the will of the United States to take the fight to the enemy in all its dimensions.
And specifically, in striking Northern Helmand and the drug enterprises there, we're hitting the Taliban where it hurts, which is their finances.
General Nicholson said the strikes occur only after numerous hours of surveillance, not only to pinpoint the specific objective, but to minimize collateral damage. He also made clear that the U.S. and Afghan forces are not targeting the farmers who grow the poppies. The farmers are often compelled to do so by the Taliban as a payment of debt or form of coerced servitude. Instead, the targets are the labs where poppies are processed into opium, morphine, and eventually into heroin. General Nicholson said the level of trust between the United States and Afghanistan has never been higher.
And it's because of this that we're able to conduct these kind of joint operations. And we're able to do these operations with the full support and indeed leadership of the Afghan government.
General Nicholson said the U.S. and Afghanistan will continue to apply military pressure on the enemy and that the international community's increased diplomatic and economic pressure is having an effect on the external enablers of the insurgency. Credible elections in Afghanistan will add crucial needed social pressure. These are the things that will mean that the Taliban cannot win, said General Nicholson. Our message to them is, it's time to lay down your arms and enter into a reconciliation process.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.